Miss Pierce, reel 7.
Well, the next day two of us got together and we decided that it looked as though we were going to be aboard rather a long time. The ship was not going directly to England. It was having to do a tremendous amount of zigzagging as the channel was alive with enemy submarines. And we had no idea how long we would be getting home. So I thought, well, there are all these able-bodied people. Certainly they've paid for their cabins, but that doesn't count anymore now. We're at war. We're desperate. And if we could only find out which of them weren't seasick genuinely, and if they could vacate their cabins during the day, we could do relays of refugees 3 hours at a time for a rest in the cabins. So we went to the purser, and I asked him if this was feasible, and he said he thought it was a very good idea, that I'd find all sorts of very selfish people, and he was ashamed to say that a lot of them were English young men who'd gone off on a holiday, you know, and still couldn't understand it. I think the whole thing was not selfishness, it was a complete lack of understanding. You see, we'd seen things that they hadn't. And how can you make people realize the utter chaos that had just been left behind? They'd been having fun. How could they see it? Anyway, we spent the day going round all the cabins, and we got one. We asked them if they were seasick. Of course, some of them, beginning to realize what we were up to, said they were and could possibly leave their cabins, so we didn't bother them. But a great many, especially among older people and the very young, what I call the very young, the 20s and the 19s and the 18s, were very generous. And among the very younger ones, they even gave up their cabins for the permanently. They were most generous. During which time, we realized that we couldn't work. We were also nursing at the same time among the refugees, and some of those who were midwives were helping with the births that were taking place all over the ship. We couldn't possibly sleep down in that hold with all these refugees, that we must try and find somewhere else. Well, the British officers, ship's officers, asked the captain if they could give up their cabins to us, but he wouldn't allow it. And then we found a mess deck where there were, I can't remember whether it's 5 or 6 or less, French officers who had found some mattresses and put them on the tables of the mess decks. Why there were these mess decks, I don't know, unless it was ship's company probably used it normally. And so we were much more comfortable because the British officers sent us down their mattresses and bedding and pillows, and the French officers slept one end and we slept t'other end, and we were very much more comfortable, of course. Well, to get back to our rota, it worked to a certain extent, excepting that when the refugees did get to the cabins, they'd changed their minds, a lot of them, and they were seasick after all. But we did our best, that's all I can say. And whilst we were going round, we came to a very interesting cabin. For there were two guards, one on either side of it in some peculiar uniform, unarmed. And somebody said to us, I shouldn't bother to knock on that door. It's King Zog of Albania, and he won't give in. So I thought, well, just for the fun of it, I will. He's got two unarmed guards. Obviously, the captain had done, and we found afterwards that the captain had unarmed them. And he'd got all his gold bullion aboard. Imagine that. He had his wife and all sorts of women people in there.
Did you actually see him?
Yes. I can't remember what he looked like, so I'm awfully sorry to let you down. It's such a long time ago, and it was only for a few seconds, because we'd no intention of using his cabin, but we weren't going to let him off without bothering him. And we asked him, you know, if it was possible. Certainly not. His wife was not at all well, and he himself was not at all well, and, you know, the usual. He was not at all pleasant, and we'd no intention of sending anyone there. And when we went back to the purser, he said, oh, I could have told you not to bother to go there. I said, well, as a matter of fact, I think it was a little bit of spite and a little bit of curiosity that made me do it. So there they were. And we took 10 days zigzagging, food getting less and less, more and more peeling of potatoes on the deck, all joining in by now, all beginning to realize that all was not well, and our young men coming down to help. Who at first, you know, had not understood at all what was going on. Evelyn was mending fairly well because she was no longer trailing all over France, so she was no longer a stretcher case. And eventually we arrived at, was it Southampton? It's in there. And we found that we were called the Lost Unit. Lost indeed. We were never lost as far as we were concerned. We were just making our way home as best we could. We'd never thought of ourselves as being lost. However, apparently we'd been in all the papers, questions asked in the house about this unit of English MTC drivers and nurses who were lost somewhere in France. And we were overwhelmed with kindness at the port. The Red Cross sent telegrams to our friends and relatives for us. The only people that I complain of a little bit were that the press were rather pushing, because we were desperately tired. We were wildly excited at being home, of course. And all we wanted to do was to get home, to get somewhere and get cleaned up and tidied up before people saw us. And they wanted us to put French tin hats on our heads and pose and all that sort of thing. We'd had French tin hats, but I don't think one of us had ever worn them. And certainly weren't going to start, tired as we were, stand on a railway station and pose for the press in tin hats. Well, eventually we arrived in London, and Mrs. Spears took rooms at the hotel, was it Euston or St. Pancras, one of those big hotels. And we each had a room and a bath. And I remember, I think I spent, and I think we all did the same, most of the night having baths. Kept on running more and more hot water and washing my hair and having another bath, you know. And we had managed to, on the train going up, sponge our clothes and make ourselves as respectable as we could. And next morning when we went down to breakfast, remember, rationing had started. We didn't know, of course. But the stewards in the restaurant just raided every table around and put sugar and butter galore and All the guests seemed to be only too pleased and too willing. Such was the spirit of mankind in those days, that everybody wanted to help everybody else, if you know what I mean. And we were overwhelmed with an enormous breakfast and all this butter which was collected up from various tables and the sugar. And finally, we went our various ways, homes or to home or to friends, in my case, to friends at Hazelmere in Surrey. And we were given some time off, and during which time we didn't know whether we were going to reform into a unit. We heard rumours that General Spears had got this French general who had formed a group calling themselves the Free French Forces, and that daily there were people escaping. For instance, on the ship coming home, there were young boy scouts who left France to come and fight for her. I remember well one of them, because I met him again in Beirut later as a young lieutenant. He'd cribbed his age and everything else, you know, and he was not as old as he said he was, and there he was, a young lieutenant. But at this stage, there were all sorts of people, young and old, who came over in order to fight for France, knowing that England was the only place they could do it from, or thinking that England was the only place they could do it from at that time, which it was.
Before you go on with what did happen to the unit, why did your friend, the nurse, even fall off, become a stretcher case?
She had phlebitis.
Was that coincidental, or had that to do with the conditions?
I think conditions precipitated it, but I think she had circulatory trouble all her life. Because many years later, when I met her, I've lost her again, but when I did meet her, she was being treated for circulatory trouble then. But she had two bad bouts of it. The conditions didn't help someone with a leg like that.
No, why wasn't she sent back to England?
How could she
earlier?
Be?
No, earlier.
It was utterly impossible, because read and listen to my descriptions, we couldn't get across France, so how could we send her across? You see, she didn't develop it till we started retreating, till we were in full retreat.
I see.
And then eventually became a stretcher case, because it was, instead of lying in bed and keeping it still, she was hopping in and out of vehicles and trying to start a hospital and not giving in, you see. I mean, nobody gave in to anything, because we just hadn't got time to give in to anything. In fact, you didn't even think of it, I don't believe. You don't in an emergency. You think of what's got to be done.
The unit at various times was in great difficulty and danger. Were any of the individual members actually in danger at any point, getting separated from the unit or...
Yes, we used to worry occasionally when Mrs. Spears used to go off with one of the MTC drivers, Rosie Forbes, and sometimes Cynthia Toulmin or Barbara Graham, to look for the general, because we still didn't realise that we weren't going to reform somewhere and start up a hospital. And for days and days we didn't hear from her. And we were ordered to move on, and we didn't know whether she'd find us. She always did, of course. One can presume that she was in danger, but no more danger than we were in. We were all in danger. There was the occasion during the retreat, I hope I'm not repeating myself, whether I've mentioned it or not, when on a lower road to ours, we saw the Boche in a small convoy, and we stopped all our, we had lots of vehicles then, we stopped all our convoy and we turned everything round by hand and pushed every vehicle from Dodges to cars by hand. We pushed them 3 miles so that they wouldn't hear the engines, turned them all round and pushed them back the way we'd come. I think that was the nearest we were to being caught. Now, we're on holiday and we don't know, I think that's where we've got to. Lots of us wanted to continue to help the Free French. And whilst we nurses were away, some of the MTC drivers had gone to General de Gaulle and offered him their cars. We left all our cars in France, but I presume they bought some more. They had their family cars or what, because they were quite rich girls. And they drove General de Gaulle and his officers around until he could, you know, get things organized. Then Mrs. Spears called us back to, at the time, run a small sick bay and start a canteen at Delville Camp, Aldershot, where the French were.
Yes, but before that, what were you doing when you returned to France? And there were just a few months there.
Ah, yes. Well, I went to Hazelmere and then I went to my father. My father and mother were divorced, you see, and I hadn't got much to do with them. But I went to my father and to find that he was on his way to France. Now, he was an old man. He was not a young man. But he had known Thomas Cook and he had blazed many a trail, when it really was Thomas Cook's, for various safaris in Africa to take place, rich Americans to come over, you know. And he also knew Europe inside out, if anybody did. And who it was who asked him to do this, I will never know. But he was asked to go back and to bring a VIP back to England somehow. Who the VIP was, I've made many a guess, but I don't know. And Daddy died with the secret. I do know that he must have gone well inland, almost to Switzerland, or whether he went to Switzerland or not, I don't know. And then had to find his way through what was then very dangerous France, via Spain, to England. Meanwhile, I told him that I had talked to some of these Red Cross nurses that we had met who'd siphoned petrol for us. And they were very keen on trying to form escape routes. I think you've spoken to many a First World War nurse, and you know that nurses somehow or other have always been connected with forming escape routes. We've only got Edith Cavell to think of.
Yes, exactly.
But not that we were any Edith Cavells. So I said to Daddy, I'd had this conversation. He said, I can get you to France. After that, it's finished. We have no more connection with each other. What happens, what you do, or how you get back is your own business. So I'm afraid that I don't want to dwell on it, certainly not on how we got there. And I did manage to make contact, but there was treachery somewhere, and I had to get back to England. Now, all this fitted in a very short time, which was my leave. So I never had to tell them, and the Hatfield Spears unit never knew and doesn't know to this day where I went on leave.
Does that mean that you weren't able, in fact, to get involved with them at all?
I was involved with them, and it was while I was involved with them that some unfortunate incident happened, and they got me out of the country for my own safety.
Thank you.
I got in touch. By devious ways, by speaking French only, and having my French birth certificate on me, I went towards the spot where we had last seen the convoy and found that there was a Red Cross unit billeted in a town nearby. And I met one of those that I had spoken to. We were able to discuss various things. We'd even got a plan vaguely formed in our minds. We'd been to her commandant and spoken to her about it. When it was quite certain that someone was passing this information on already. And I'd rather not say any more about it, because there isn't anything more to say, excepting that I was lucky to, again, get away from France as I did.
Were you able to get away?
I was bitterly disappointed that I couldn't stay and do this. But then later on, of course, when we were formed back into a unit, I was just as glad because we were still doing war work.
Were you able to get away safely without coming up against the Germans?
Oh, no, there was a night when I was in a pigsty. We went in for pigsties and cowsheds, as you know. And it was really rather amusing because we were in this pigsty and it was nice and warm, and they were going to kill one of the piglets next day and take it back to have some food, and we were going to cook some. Then we heard a German voice in another pigsty cell just the other side of the partition. So we vamoosed.
When was Mrs. Spears' unit reformed then?
Well, then, after a short leave, she recalled us to Delville Camp at Aldershot, where by now the Free French were stationed. They'd been allocated this camp. And canteens had to be started up, and they were all run by voluntary workers and under our authority, you know, they belong to us, as it were. And there was a little sick bay we had, and I was given it, which I was very pleased to have, and we slept in various hut rooms all over the place, dotted hither and thither. Near the canteen. I was right opposite one canteen, and near my little sick bay. We even had a reunion where we had wine in the French officers' mess, and I'll bring it to you one day. I have a little card which is shaped like the pocket of a French uniform, and hanging from the pocket as a medal is a little horseshoe, and inside those that were present signed and passed remarks about this dear little nurse and all that nonsense, you know. But one very interesting sentence on the card is, "From the only father serving with his son in the Free French Forces." They'd both escaped together, father and son. And during this time, while we were at Delville Camp, we didn't know all that was going on, but we knew too much because tongues wagged frightfully. It was absolutely appalling the way people spoke. I mean, the whole of Camberley knew everything that was going on. And all round about, they all knew everything, because the French didn't keep quiet at that time, not quiet enough. And the Foreign Legion began to arrive. And we were nearing the time of, was it Dakar that we went to try and get the French warships?
Yes.
That's right. We were nearing this time, and we knew, so if we knew, the whole of the neighborhood knew, that that night the Foreign Legion were to be entrained and to move off and to join a ship and to go and help the British take these French warships that were taking refuge over there. Unfortunately, there was too much talk. There was a bomb on the line near Aldershot. That was got over, but they were ready for them when they got there, and as you know, it failed. We never did capture any of the warships there.